It's a rare thing to have most of the world sympathize with the great power of their day. But that was what happened right after two planes crashed into the Twin Towers, destroying thousands of innocent lives. Even the likes of Cuba, Libya, and North Korea condemned the attacks. In Iran, vigils were held for the victims, and Ali Khamenei personally sent his condolences. Rarely, if ever, had America enjoyed so much goodwill. Now imagine for a second that President Bush had sat on his hands at that point. What if he had done nothing? What if he had explained to the world that the aim of the terrorists is to drag the USA into a war which would hurt innocents, making the terrorists point for them, and that America would refuse to take the bait? What do you think? Would we have more radicalism? Would we have more terrorism? Or less? And how different would America's reputation be? As Gandhi demonstrated, if you get your ass kicked in front of cameras while remaining peaceful yourself, then you have already defeated your enemy in the realm of public opinion, which, let's be honest, is where any war on terror will have to be won or lost. Granted, if Bush had done that, it would probably be interpreted as a sign of weakness by some, but it would also send a message to terrorists worldwide that attacking America wouldn't bring them any closer to their goal. But perhaps a better question would be, how would the American public react? They were angry as hell, and understandably so. Their country was the strongest ever, and now they had the backing of almost the entire world. How do you explain to them that no one was going to be punished for this, at least not in the short term? Surely, countless Americans would demand retaliation, immediately. It was bad enough that their government had let this happen. It would look positively lax if it didn't lash out straight away. And so Bush did what he felt he had to do. He made it clear that he shared those feelings of vengefulness. He declared war on terror, and since you can't literally make war on an idea, of course, or even on a group like Al-Qaeda, he announced that he would make no distinction between terrorists and the countries that sheltered them. First on the list, unsurprisingly, were the Taliban. They sheltered the terrorist responsible, and what's more, they refused to give him up. Attacking them was therefore logical, I think. There would inevitably be innocent victims, but despite that, the international community was able to support this. Not long after, though, the US did something that most did not comprehend or condone. It started preparing a war on Iraq as well. Why? Well, allegedly because Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, was developing weapons of mass destruction, and they believed there was a serious risk that he was going to sell them to Al-Qaeda. So they felt that a preventive invasion of Iraq was the only way to make sure that terrorists couldn't threaten the world with weapons of mass destruction. In those days, kids would entertain themselves by counting the number of times that Bush used the word terror in his speeches, practically in every sentence. The ramifications were rather less funny, however. Even back then, experts scoffed at the supposed reasons for starting the Iraq War. For starters, although Saddam had sponsored terror groups over the years, Al-Qaeda was not one of them. On the contrary, under his secular surveillance state, jihadists found it nearly impossible to operate in Iraq. As for WMDs, according to Peter Galbraith, among others, Western companies had helped Iraq to obtain chemical weapons, and during the Iran-Iraq War, Westerners even provided intelligence that helped use these efficiently. The US didn't lift a finger when Saddam used chemical weapons against his own people in the 90s. So if it was about that, it would be a strange reason for invading now. Nukes were a different matter, however. You could never be sure that Saddam wasn't secretly developing them, given his lack of cooperation with nuclear inspections. But if the US considered that a valid reason for an invasion, it was a fair question why it never attacked, say, North Korea. Their nuclear program was out in the open. Most likely, that was the main reason why it was not invaded. Attacking a country that may actually have atom bombs is risky. The US never seemed all that concerned about Iraq's military capabilities, however, and in the eyes of many, that showed that the US didn't really think there were any nukes, or that Saddam was close to obtaining them. If he had, he would be left alone, most likely. The signal that this sent to other rogue regimes, by the way, was the complete opposite of what was intended. Make sure that you get one or more bombs, quietly and quickly. After the invasion, it was soon confirmed that there were no nukes to be found, although some would maintain that they could have been smuggled across the border. More on that in a minute. Now, if the objective had been to hurt Al-Qaeda, then that would backfire as well. And how? As I said, Saddam's Iraq was a no-go zone for radical Islamists. But when it lost the war, the security apparatus, the army, and the border patrols all melted away. Iraq morphed overnight from an all-controlling police state to a failed state. Al-Qaeda operatives naturally took advantage to develop a foothold in Iraq. They could convince many Muslims that this was a war against their religion. After all, Bush was an outspoken Christian, and he even used crusader terminology at times. Perhaps most damningly of all, the US did next to nothing to avoid weapons depots being plundered. According to Galbraith, even uranium was left unsecured. So one or two things has to be true, I think. Either the Bush administration was very badly informed and incompetent, or, despite its rhetoric, it wasn't in the least worried about weapons of mass destruction or terrorism whatsoever. Once that the US was in Iraq, however, the acclaimed reasons for being there would subtly change. Saddam had to go because he was an expansionist, genocidal dictator. Well, hard to argue with that, as we'll see in the next episode. The Iraqi people could rejoice now, for America had come to bring them the gift of democracy. Understandably, outside powers were less enthusiastic about that. There were plenty of other aggressive dictators out there. Was the US now going to depose all of them? The universal support that America had enjoyed 2 years earlier had almost completely vanished by that point. Also, because of how the US handled the occupation, as much as it claimed to care about Iraq becoming a functioning democracy, it didn't put its money where its mouth was. The first thing you need to do when you want to change a political system is make sure that people are noticeably better off than before. At the very least, you need to enforce security and ensure basic goods are provided for. Instead, looters roamed the streets with impunity. The power was out most of the time, garbage started piling up in the streets, and people got hungry. Perhaps that was not completely avoidable, but it sure didn't look as if it was a priority to fix it. For instance, Peter Galbraith narrates how the Ministry of Irrigation, which contained vital documentation about water projects on which millions depended, simply went up in flames, while no serious effort was made to save it. While at a stone throw's distance, the Ministry of Oil was unharmed, protected by US troops. Indeed, if Iraq had anything that really touched the national security of the United States, it was oil. America was a big importer of oil at the time. The shale boom was nowhere in sight. It had become dependent on Saudi Arabia. But that's where most of the 9/11 perpetrators came from. Not a comfortable situation. Shortly before the invasion, Vice President Cheney predicted that the demand for oil would soon skyrocket, and that Iraqi oil could help fill that demand. Indeed, if America were to enjoy free access to its huge reserves, that would be a welcome diversification. So it's no wonder that the Saudis were opposed to the invasion of Iraq, even though they were not exactly on friendly terms with it. Not only did Iraq have one of the world's largest proven oil reserves, more importantly, they were easily accessible and cheaply processable. It's all well and good to have lots of oil, but if the price on the market is lower than what you would need to cover your production costs, it wouldn't do you any good, would it? Iraq didn't have that problem, which potentially made it a major player. The reason it wasn't under Saddam was that it was subject to heavy sanctions. After reports emerged that millions of Iraqi citizens were starving as a result of these sanctions, from the second half of the 90s onward, the UN started a program known as Oil for Food. Under this program, Iraq would be allowed to sell some of its oil, but the payments would not go into its treasury. They could only be used to buy food, medicines, and other basic supplies, as opposed to weapons. Well, that was the theory. In practice, however, Saddam's government was allowed to choose whom it worked with. And it preferred partners that agreed to siphon part of their profits back to the regime. Saddam could then use it for precisely those purposes that the program was meant to prevent. It was still profitable for his trading partners because Iraq was able to sell way below the market price. The main beneficiaries were in Russia and France, two countries, by the way, that would loudly speak out against the Iraq war. American oil companies, to their chagrin, were practically left out of the food for oil scheme. Probably not a coincidence given the Gulf War and such. Now, as it happened, these oil majors were among the most generous contributors to the Bush election campaign. Plenty of key figures in his administration were oil men, including the Bush family themselves. Dick Cheney, his vice president, perhaps the biggest hawk on Iraq of them all, only retired from oil service firm Halliburton just before entering government, netting a generous farewell check, by the way. Halliburton would be awarded key contracts in post-war Iraq, and according to critics, there was no open bidding involved in this. The Economist at the time felt that that wouldn't really matter, as Halliburton was uniquely qualified for the job anyway, except for one competitor, which happened to be French. Critics would point out, though, that this fantastic business opportunity for Halliburton would simply not have existed had it not been for the war that its former CEO had helped bring about. So perhaps little wonder that the more conspiracy-minded folks out there felt that it was all about oil. Was it? Well, hard to say, but one thing is for sure. If those clamoring for invasion were hoping that this would solve America's energy problems, then they were in for an unpleasant surprise. The oil wells were set on fire. Some claim that this was a naive effort to disturb the navigation of American planes, but more probably, I think, it was intended to create economic headaches in the aftermath. Indeed, when things calmed down, the occupiers found that oil installations were severely damaged, and they had been in a sorry state already, as Iraq had been in no position to pay for the necessary maintenance and investments, because of those crippling sanctions, of course. Repairing all the damages and getting everything up to speed would take time and cost a ton of money, even if the circumstances had been ideal, which of course they were anything but. Iraq was bankrupt and therefore totally unable to cough up the money, and the political chaos that ensued did not exactly appeal to outside investors, as you can imagine. So the US would have to step in and lend out the money itself. Even then, it would still take years before Iraq sold significantly more than under Saddam. Only now, 20 years after the fact, is the country becoming much richer fast. And it's not as if this was not predictable. Indeed, it was predicted, and more than once. The Bush administration must have read these reports too. It must have realized it would take years before Iraq could be of any use for America's energy problems whatsoever. Were they just over-optimistic then? Or, on the contrary, super cynical? For I suppose it was still good business for some campaign donors, if not for the US Treasury, perhaps. You can ask the same question about the terrorism argument, or about the argument about promoting democracy. Perhaps it was believed that Saddam was going to sell weapons of mass destruction to Al-Qaeda, or perhaps that was also just a lousy excuse. Did they really think that the transition was going to go smoothly, or was it more that they just didn't care that much? My guess would be that it was a combination of both. After all, more than one person is involved in such decisions and risk assessments. Now, you can frame it any way you like, but by now, it's all a bit water under the bridge, isn't it? Never mind the intentions, what are the consequences? Well, to play the devil's advocate for a moment, Iraq is still a democracy, right? And it has been for all this time. Was that not better than the murderous autocracy that came before? And now that it finally has the means to become prosperous, it might still become an inspiration for the region. How ironic would that be, right? But even if that were the case, and I'm certainly not making any predictions, one might still ask, will it have been worth it? Before you can make that calculation, you have to know what happened in the aftermath of the invasion. But first, let us take a look at what was happening in Syria. There too, the attacks on the Twin Towers had been a turning point. Shortly before, there had been reasons for optimism. The longtime dictator Hafez al-Assad had died of a heart attack. According to some, while he was talking on the phone to a minister in Lebanon, which Syria occupied at the time. The heir apparent had also died in an accident not long before that, which meant that a younger son of his, Bashar, was recalled from England to take charge of the country. He was in many ways the hope of the nation and beyond. Bashar was the only family member who had lived in the West. According to his biographer, there, as in his Syria, he was known as modest, friendly, and mild. Not at all the type that's out for riches, glory, or power. He must have been very bright, too. If you're not, you won't be allowed to perform eye surgery in England, I suppose. The fact that he had chosen to study medicine also seemed to indicate that he was more intent on helping people than hurting them. He married a glamorous banker who didn't appear Syrian at all. What's more, her family was Sunni, which seemed to indicate that the new president didn't think in sectarian terms, which would be refreshing. Under his father Hafez, the Sunni majority was kept away from the true levers of power. Key positions were reserved for Alawites, most of them from the clan of Hafez al-Assad and that of his wife. Perhaps for that reason, Bashar's Sunni wife was not accepted by her in-laws at first, according to The Economist at least. So with the arrival of this young, Western-educated president, there was hope that Syria would now change for the better. Bashar's first public appearances did nothing to dim these high expectations. On the contrary, he talked constantly about the need for reform, for rights and freedoms. Prisoners were released. Criticism was permitted, on a scale not seen since long. Alas, this so-called Damascus Spring soon turned out to be a Fata Morgana. On September 11, 2001, of all times, a major crackdown began. It now seemed as if the regime had been waiting for such an opportunity. The world press was focused on other things that day, as you can imagine. This still fuels debate about whether Bashar's reformist persona had been a pose all along, or whether he had been called to order by the security apparatus. It's a fair question. Imagine that you were in his shoes. You have a comfortable life as a doctor in Europe. You are then asked by your family to take charge of what is broadly considered a mafia state, run by ruthless people who are used to doing whatever they like with impunity. Now, if you tell them, "Party's over, folks," or if you refuse to play by their rules, I guess you're unlikely to be around for long. That would make you a martyr, but for what purpose? I think most people would be terrified in that situation, wouldn't you? In theory, Bashar could have refused to have anything to do with all this, but that would mean that one of his brothers would have to do it, or indeed some unscrupulous person from outside the family might take charge, which might endanger his loved ones or lead to political chaos. In his book, The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar's biographer, Professor Lesh, writes this about the new president. Quote, "Bashar is basically a principled man. He's very unassuming, his laugh that of an innocent young man. His voice is not a commanding type, yet what he has to say holds your attention because of his appealing sincerity." Unquote. Now listen what he says about how others who met Bashar talk about him. Quote, "He is such a sweet and gentle person," emerges as a common observation, "but it's almost always followed in the same breath with something like, 'But he's not tough enough to get it done.'" End quote. Now, this was written well before the Civil War, and with the hindsight that we now have, you may be inclined to think that this biographer was clearly misled. And indeed, some of his observations do sound a bit naive, it needs to be said. For instance, it struck him that Bashar even proposed to change his own schedule to make time for an interview. It's easy to be cynical about this, I think. It's not hard to see why he would have wanted to appear so likable, knowing that this would determine his image in the West. When I started reading The New Lion of Damascus, my first thought was, boy, this poor man must be sorry he ever wrote that book by now. But this is a respected scholar, and when he starts to analyze Syrian politics, he doesn't sound naive at all. For instance, he wrote the following warning, quote, "Countrywide, unemployment is estimated at between 20% and 25%, although it could be higher and rise even further. Now, if this were to continue unabated, it would be a recipe for social unrest, led especially by growing Islamic extremism in the country, With the repressive apparatus of the state, if this unrest occurs, things could get very ugly, and Bashar would be faced with some incalculably tough decisions." End quote. That almost sounds prophetic now, doesn't it? His main point is that the Syrian regime was held afloat by bureaucrats who support the Assads in return for unaccountability. Bashar knows that the bloated and corrupt public sector holds the economy back, which, while frustrating the rest of society, but if he sacked these people, they would surely turn on him. As evidence, Lesh points to the murder of the Lebanese president Hariri, a former ally of the Syrians who had fallen out with them. Dr. Lesh suspects that Bashar was left out of the loop on this assassination thing. If so, then this would be a warning to him as much as to Lebanese politicians. Be that as it may, nowadays few people still think Bashar was ever a reformist at heart. I'm not a psychiatrist and I evidently haven't met the man. David Lesh has. I don't mean to shock you, but suppose he is right on this, with his appraisal of Bashar as a principled, modest, and caring man. Then, isn't it fascinating that when things seem to fall apart, this regime acts no less diabolically than that of a sadistic maniac like Saddam? Just for the heck of it, imagine the best single person you can think of, and then imagine him in the position of the Syrian president. What would Jesus do, say? And would it make any difference, you think? Either of three things has to be true. Either he was always a bad person, as many of his detractors claim, for that he'd have to be a brilliant actor for his entire life, which sounds a bit unlikely, or he was and still is all those things that his biographer says. Or, somewhere along the way, his character changed 180 degrees. Is it just the clothes making the man? Or a severe case of Breaking Bad, perhaps? Interestingly, David Lesh quotes the man himself denying this. Quote, "I don't feel myself being president. I feel myself as Bashar. I haven't changed. Nothing has changed." End quote. Now, I don't understand it either way, but whatever version is true, it blows my mind. Now, even if Bashar al-Assad didn't inherit his father's character, he certainly did inherit his limited options. We already talked about the patronage system that cannot be changed without the insiders revolting. With foreign policy, the choices were even more limited. His father had always legitimized his actions and the need for a strong security state by pointing to the threat of Israel. The Jewish state still occupied the Golan Heights, which are not just crucial for natural pride, but also for strategic reasons. It's an ideal platform to launch attacks on the Syrian capital, but also for an attack on Israel. And it is also crucial for Israel's water supply, so it probably has no intention of ever returning it. But for its part, the Syrian regime can't afford to make peace without the prospect of returning its territory, not after having made such a fuss over it all these years. However, that's precisely what the Bush administration demanded. When he declared war on terror, Bush infamously said, "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists." For most countries, there was really only one choice. But not for Assad, because Bush made it clear that in his case, "with us" would entail seeking peace with Israel, without the latter having to make any concessions. That would be indigestible. Bush also demanded that Syria retreat from Lebanon. Now, the Israeli invasion there had been the reason for Hafez to enter the Lebanese civil war, and safeguarding against Israel's return became his avowed reason for sticking around. Syria argued that if they left, Israel could return whenever it wanted to Lebanon and thereby outflank Syria. So these two American demands were closely interrelated. Syria would have to surrender to Israel on all fronts, while antagonism toward the Jewish state and sympathy for the Palestinians, that was one of the few things that bound the Syrian regime and its people together. As if to make the option of peace even more unpalatable, the right-wing Israeli politician Ariel Sharon then thought it would be a good idea to visit the esplanade of the mosque in Jerusalem, along with 1,000 guards. This provoked the Palestinians to launch the Second Intifada, which would become a very bloody affair. It had the full support of the Syrian population. It would be the worst possible time for their president to agree to unconditional peace talks. Assad understood the possible ramifications of defying America, but he feared the reactions of accepting its terms even more, both from the Syrian people and from the hardliners within his regime. So he decided to withstand the American pressure. Bush was not amused, but punishing Syria would have to wait for now. He had more urgent business to attend to in Iraq. Perhaps he expected that shouldn't take too long. The military invasion in itself was not really a problem. When Comical Ali, as he became known, Saddam's Joseph Goebbels, made outrageous claims about American troops fleeing like rats, this was not frightful to American viewers, it was good fun. In the same vein, Bush was quick to give a celebratory speech in front of a giant banner declaring, "Mission accomplished." But he would soon regret those badly chosen words. His administration seems to have imagined that the grateful Iraqi population would spontaneously choose legitimate leaders who would work together to build a working democracy. This would render a long, costly occupation unnecessary, but that soon proved to be a pipe dream. Smooth transition of power was never on the cards. Firstly, because the population was not overall so happy with the American presence to begin with. Who could forget the images of enraged Iraqis bringing down a giant statue of Saddam and kicking it with their shoes? Well, iconic as they are also a bit misleading. Zoom out, and the square where this happens seems strikingly empty given the circumstances. It is a reminder that pictures are not more objective than words. In reality, the invasion was probably unpopular from the start, and for many reasons, perhaps most of all because it was presented as a civilizing mission at times. But this was a people that was well aware that they were the cradle of civilization. Saddam had hammered that home for decades. So you could hear the Iraqis thinking, how old are these United States again? Where do they get the pretension to think that they can lecture us about civilization? We invented it. For many Muslims, the thought of an Islamic country being occupied by Christians would be hard to swallow under any conditions. The unfortunate use of terms like crusade poured gasoline on the fire, and then came the revelation that prisoners in Abu Ghraib were submitted to fate-related humiliations. Often, the most tactless of all were the mercenaries, hired to keep the number of returning body bags artificially low. These didn't care about making America look benign. If you join such a group, I suppose you fight for money, and perhaps some would get a kick out of it even. All told, there was plenty of rhetorical ammunition for a jihad, and also no lack of the material sought because the army depots had been plundered. The fact that troops didn't have permission to stop the looting or protect civilians, that further tarnished their reputation. What the occupiers did do often compounded the chaos. The remnants of the army and security apparatus were officially dissolved because they were expected to be loyal to the old regime. But without them, inevitably, all order disappeared. Schools, hospitals, and museums were all plundered. Since no one protected civilians, they had to protect themselves, and so they organized in militias. Unsurprisingly, most of these recruited exclusively in one sect and ethnicity, and many were very anti-American. Perhaps the most potent of them was Muqtada al-Sadr's Shiite Army of the Mahdi. After Saddam was finally plucked out of a hole in the ground, he was put on trial, giving him ample opportunity to denounce the occupation. His conviction to death by hanging was celebrated ecstatically, especially by Shiites, but this angered his erstwhile adherents, and there were still many, especially among Sunnis. Divide and rule had always been one of Saddam's strong points, and he continued practicing it even from beyond the grave. Meanwhile, insurrectionists could freely cross the Syrian border in both directions. America put enormous pressure on Damascus to stop this, but it convincingly pointed out that the border was extremely long and that Syria lacked the means to secure it. That said, Assad had every reason for wanting the Iraqi occupation to become a disaster. That would discredit the Bush doctrine and dim the appetite for another intervention in Syria. But Assad could not be seen as actively undermining the Americans in Iraq, of course. That might provoke a reaction as well. So he was really walking a tightrope there. Also entering Iraq were Al-Qaeda members. These keenly widened the sectarian schism further by launching terror attacks that were, as always, intended to provoke overreactions. They often succeeded. For instance, when Shiite processions and shrines were attacked, the Shiite militias exacted revenge upon Sunnis. With every act of revenge, Iraq descended further into civil war. The American administration was not ready for it. In fact, if Peter Galbraith is to be believed, those responsible for transforming Iraq had no idea what they were getting themselves into. He asserts that the man who led the Coalition Provisional Authority, or the CPA, had no experience of Iraq whatsoever, and that he was given a mere 2 weeks to prepare, can you imagine? Worse, he claims he heard from two witnesses that a mere 2 months before he sent troops to Iraq, Bush himself had no clue that there was such a thing as Sunnism and Shiism. And finally, that the Americans reckoned Iran wouldn't gain influence on the Iraqi Shiites, seemingly unaware that their biggest party was created and funded by Iran. I don't know if I believe all that, but it seems clear that they underestimated the fragility of Iraq. Optimism may well be a moral duty, as they say, but in case you're contemplating invading a country, you do well to have a plan B, just in case things don't work out. Plan A was to count on the Iraqis to clean up the mess themselves. When that didn't happen, the Americans had to begin to improvise. They chose to temporarily take matters into their own hands, but that would be pretty complicated, of course, and they hadn't prepared for that occasion. So, true to the dominant ideology of the time, they fell back on known neoliberal recipes, for example, by seeking to sell off public companies. But these were so notoriously poorly led that no reasonable offers came in. This country had never functioned like a liberal economy, so this shock therapy didn't work. Yet no one came up with any alternatives. Often, those in power then decided not to decide. Large swaths of the economy were simply left to wither. Those in charge of the public purse were apparently hyper-cautious about spending money, but this meant that nothing could get done. While the country was still in ruins, of course, and basic goods were lacking. This inertia infuriated the Iraqis. They started to quip that CPA stood for can't provide anything. All the while, cheap imports would flood the market, bankruptcies piled up, and the streets filled with angry, idle men. Another reason why rebuilding Iraq went badly was corruption. As before, Iraq continued to run on cash, and there was little control over how it would be spent. Officers received payments for their troops in banknotes. Apparently, some of their soldiers only existed on paper, and so the commander could keep the money for himself. That may partly explain why the army was surprisingly unable to resist ISIL when it took over Mosul, for example. On paper, there were more than enough troops, but perhaps in reality, their numbers were not that formidable. What's also telling is that despite the humongous sums that were spent on repairing the electricity grid, there were more blackouts under the CPA than under Saddam. The temporary government was not just incompetent, it also lacked legitimacy. Instead of allowing the locals to decide how their future would look, the transitional government tried to get an advisory council of locals to rubber stamp its own decisions, and it kept executive, legislative, and judiciary authority in its own hands for quite some time, not exactly democratic. The longer this lasted, the more it infuriated the Shiites, because as the majority, they felt they were entitled to determine their country's direction. And the longer the CPA remained in place, the more they felt this right was being withheld from them. And to be honest, it may well be that US officials were suspicious of their plans. The biggest Shiite party, created in Iran, went by the ominous name Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. A repetition of the Iranian Revolution was presumably not what the Americans had in mind. The leader of another Shiite bloc, al-Sadr, was openly hostile to America, and Ayatollah al-Sistani, the leading Shiite cleric and perhaps the most influential person in Iraq, even refused to meet any American officials. This mutual suspicion would in time drive many Shiites to revolt. The Sunnis, for their part, were even less cooperative, as they understood all too well that any democratic government would mean that they would lose out against the Shiite majority. was therefore very hard to find Sunni politicians with popular appeal who were willing to work toward a national compromise. Granted, elections were held so that the government could at least show a familiar face. Since Saddam had not allowed any local opposition, old enemies of the regime, who had long fled abroad, got a prominent role. And not coincidentally, they often had a secular profile, as the Americans would have liked, but they enjoyed little support and were accused of having abandoned the country in its time of need, only to return now to do the bidding of infidel occupiers. Many Sunnis even boycotted the democratic process altogether. Being the minority, they realized all too well that they would be its dupes. Their strongest party by far would have been the Ba'ath, the former party of Saddam, but it was declared illegal. Why? Well, Saddam has often been compared to Adolf Hitler, and this is understandable, for there are more than a few similarities. Megalomania, paranoia, expansionism, genocidal tendencies. The Americans apparently imagined that they could then handle Iraq the same way they had pacified Germany after Hitler's fall. Understandable, perhaps, it never ceases to amaze that so shortly after the super-aggressive Nazis were defeated, their land would become one of the most peaceful countries in the world. Talk about a success, right? Wouldn't you want to imitate that? If you believe you can learn a thing or two from history, of course you would like to know how they did it in Germany. Well, soon after the defeat of Hitler, it was subjected to denazification, a fancy word for getting rid of the Nazis. Now, the Americans believed they could do something similar in Iraq. They started the campaign of so-called de-Ba'athification. The Ba'ath was the party of Saddam, and of the Assads too, by the way. It means something like Arab Nationalist Socialist. But in reality, at that point, it had about as much to do with socialism as the National Socialist Party of Hitler. So like the Nazi Party, the Ba'ath Party was forbidden. Everyone associated with it was dishonorably discharged from public service. Among them, the officers and bureaucrats who had kept Saddam's state of terror going. Some of them would later form the core of ISIL. Many others had never been convinced party activists. Many had obtained a membership card as a necessary evil. Under Saddam, and under the Assads too, by the way, the Ba'ath Party had become a mere tool for the leader to control society. Outside its patronage network, there were few decent jobs to be found, and the jobless had a hard time trying to survive. Also, people had rightly been terrified of Saddam's murderous regime, and they could hope that becoming a party member would be taken as a life-saving sign of submission. All these people now suddenly lost their jobs. And this was not only a problem for them, many had held key positions as teachers, doctors, or technicians. It would be impossible to replace them all in the foreseeable future. So Iraq stopped functioning. De-Ba'athification also stoked sectarian hatred, because most of those that were dismissed were Sunnis, while vacancies were now filled disproportionately by Shiites. And no wonder, the Saddam regime had marginalized Shiites as a group, so most hadn't had a chance to collaborate with it, even had they wanted to. With de-Ba'athification, Sunnis lost most of their representation in state organs. Since they boycotted the assembly that had to draw up a new constitution, they barely had a say in that too. The final draft was accepted by referendum, but it was voted down in the Sunni triangle between Baghdad, Tikrit, and Fallujah. By 2008, former Ba'athists were again welcomed in the civil service, at least on paper, but by then, it was already too late. The de-Ba'athification of the state would be followed by the Ba'athification of Al-Qaeda's Iraqi offshoot that would set out to form a new Sunni-dominated state later. The biggest winners of the whole affair may have been the Kurds. By combining their electoral power with the Shiites, they could put their mark on the constitution, ensuring that the regional autonomy that they already enjoyed in the 90s was now further reinforced. On paper, Iraq would be an Islamic state, as the Shiites demanded. Laws could be struck down if they were not in accordance with the Sharia, but crucially, that didn't apply to regional laws. So in practice, Kurdistan had another system, another type of system, much more secular than the rest of Iraq. There was a catch, though. The constitution left lots of room for interpretation when it came to the distribution of oil, and that would lead to trouble down the line. Kirkuk was one important source of Iraqi oil, Basra in the southeast was the other, and that became al-Sadr's fiefdom. The Sunni triangle in the middle, that once laid down the law in Iraq, would now become dependent on the willingness of Kurds and Shiites to share. Also, given the new dominance of the Shiites, if Sharia law became the cornerstone of the justice system, that would mostly mean the Shiite variation. Compounding the trouble of the Sunnis was the reorganization of the army and security services. In Saddam's army, while Shiites made up most of the conscripts, Sunnis dominated the officer class and the professional Republican guards, but these had been dissolved. The new army would be formed by merging and integrating the militias. In practice, that amounted to little more than handing them a uniform and paying them out of the treasury. Their command structures and loyalties remained mostly unchanged. The Peshmerga kept protecting Kurdish regions, while in Basra, al-Sadr controlled the streets. Militia bosses occupied government positions, and the ministries became their personal playground. Perhaps most crucially, the Shiite Badr Brigades took the Ministry of Internal Affairs, responsible for security. During the Civil War, they were accused of forming death squads. No wonder that Sunnis felt unsafe, perhaps nowhere more so than in al-Sadr's domain. The government would eventually act against this army of the Mahdi, but only when he left the governing coalition. And this was most of all due to the disagreement over the presence of American forces. After that, the preacher warlord moved to Iran, which is a bit ironic perhaps, since he had always accused other politicians of abandoning their country in the days of Saddam. Meanwhile, radical Sunnis left for Syria. The departure of hardliners on both sides facilitated a temporary reconciliation. Between 2007 and 2010, the civil war mercifully died down. Perhaps not by chance that this coincided with a change of tactics on the part of the USA. By December 2006, it was clear that the old strategy had totally failed. The death toll among civilians was more than 50 per day by then. The new approach would be known as the surge. This entailed not just a vast increase in the number of boots on the ground, they would also be stationed more often in neighborhoods that were prone to jihadist activities. The idea was that the bulk of the inhabitants of these regions didn't like the radicals, but were too afraid to tell on them. The presence of US troops might convince them to do so. Overall, it seems to have worked. There even appeared a so-called awakening movement of former rebels who were now willing to support the government against insurgents on the promise that they then be allowed to enter the police or the army. A promise that sadly would not be kept, which would lead to more trouble down the road. The fact that some sort of peace ensued made the American presence a bit less controversial in Iraq, but inevitably, the surge implied a bigger and more expensive commitment on the part of the USA, and overall, the American public didn't like to see their hard-earned tax dollars spent on Iraqis who didn't even seem to want them there. As the American departure neared, this affected the calculation of Iraq's leaders too. Surely, after that, the fervently Shiite Iran would become the dominant player. And with that in mind, it's not surprising that the new government of Nouri al-Maliki became increasingly more anti-Sunni. The criticism on al-Maliki mounted because of the worsening security situation, and Western governments pressured him to resign. Instead, he insisted that it was they who had to leave, and swiftly too. By 2011, he got his wish. In the meantime, as America's commitment had diminished, al-Maliki intensified his own grip on power. He strengthened his grasp on the organ that oversaw elections, on the anti-corruption agency, on the central bank. He also cracked down on the awakening movement. The very day after the last US troops left, he issued an arrest warrant against his Sunni vice president for terrorism. Many Sunnis took that as a declaration of war, and their representatives reacted by boycotting parliamentary sessions. More purges would follow. Like in the previous civil war, once again Shia militiamen, sometimes wearing army or police uniforms, killed Sunni civilians with impunity. And while all this was going on, the Arab Spring was in full swing. protests erupted in Iraq too. There were lots of things to complain about, after all. The ministries were instruments of patronage, failing to deliver the growth that had been promised. Firebrands like al-Sadr played on the anger to boost their popularity. This, and the backing of his Iranian friends, assured him that it was safe to return from exile. His supporters once again filled the streets, intimidating even the government. This understandably filled many Sunnis with dread. Jihadists and former Baathists would join forces to take advantage of their desperation. This is how ISIL came into being. It's painfully ironic that while the invasion of Iraq had been sold as a preventive measure to combat terrorism, it ended up creating the conditions for the rise of the strongest, richest, and most dangerous jihadist group in all history. Although ISIL would of course attribute its rapid expansion to the favor of Allah, no divine intervention is needed to explain this, really. For this is not just a classical terror group, it can also be seen as the resurrection of Saddam Hussein's deep state. Ever since his experienced officers, bureaucrats, and politicians were sacked, they had been looking for an opportunity to return to power. ISIL would become their vehicle. They had more experience with controlling civilians than the Iraqi government itself. Under Saddam, governing, oppressing, and terrorizing were practically the same thing. This explains, more than anything, why this new terror group was able to morph into a more or less functioning state at the blink of an eye. Years earlier, Saddam's former henchmen had already tried to rally Sunnis against the government in Baghdad. But this early attempt had failed because they weren't all that kind to the Sunnis either. So many of them were forced to flee to Syria. They managed to take outrageous sums of public money with them, however. Tellingly, about 600 million in cash was discovered in a barn near the house of Saddam's son Uday. If this is indicative, they sure had no lack of savings. More than enough to allow them to wait patiently until the Americans got packing, while sectarian tensions escalated. Then, in their new jihadist incarnation, the old guard would present themselves as the protectors and avengers of Sunnis. Naturally, the implosion of state control in Syria also helped, as did the fact that the civil war there also pitted sects against one another. In spite of their fanatical rhetoric, they once again acted cynically towards the population, Sunnis included. They probably couldn't help it, for this was all they knew. This shows, I think, that what ISIL really wanted was to create a dictatorship, and perhaps not even all that different from the Baathist regime from whose ashes it had arisen. In this, it differed from Al-Qaeda. For some, the ISIL jihad was merely a means of legitimizing their return to power, building support among Sunnis, and attracting foreign recruits. Such flexibility may seem improbable, but it was an old trick by that point. Even Saddam himself had occasionally presented himself as a holy warrior. A bit rich, given the fact that his regime had always been hostile to Islamists. Same thing with the Assads, by the way. Hafez al-Assad made sure that he was seen praying with high-ranking ulama or making the pilgrimage to Mecca, all the while doing all he could to keep political Islam at bay. Despite their commonalities, the Assads despised Saddam. But that hadn't stopped them from helping him circumvent UN sanctions by buying Iraqi oil on the cheap. This would provide Syria with a necessary source of income, which would disappear along with Saddam eventually. And to make matters worse for the Syrians, the Americans would punish them economically. The embargo would nearly suffocate them. The Syrians were also forced to leave Lebanon because throngs of Lebanese flocked onto the streets shouting anti-Syrian slogans. The direct cause was the murder of Rafik Hariri, the popular politician who had been key in rebuilding Lebanon after its civil war, but who now found himself on a collision course with Damascus. Assad didn't dare to risk escalation under such conditions. The Americans were already angry at him, such as things stood, and this might invite an attack. Which may well explain why first Hariri and later the Lebanese people had dared to defy him. Though an attack on Syria was always unlikely, as it was under Russian protection. The Russians had their Mediterranean fleet stationed in a Syrian harbor, and the Assads owed over $10 billion to Moscow. The Russians would therefore not tolerate regime change in Syria, and America was not ready to risk World War III over it. Perhaps that's the main reason why Assad could get away with subtle forms of sabotage. Well, you might also argue he didn't have to do anything except sit back and watch the insurrectionists cross his borders. As Iraq descended into chaos, the appetite for a similar adventure dampened quickly in Washington. When it became clear that Assad would be left alone, and that he wasn't going anywhere, he slowly managed to emerge from his isolation, not unlike today. What also helped him was the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon in 2006, because this allowed him to say, "See, that wouldn't have happened if we'd still been there to protect you." So from a distance, the Syrian house seemed solid, but inside it was rotting away. I already mentioned the structural problems that Syria had, and on top of that, in the years leading up to the Arab Spring, it was also ravaged by drought. The Assads, fashionistas as they are, displayed little sympathy for the poor peasantry. In this, Bashar differed from his father, who had grown up among farmers and saw them as his natural supporters. When the drought hit, funding for agriculture had just been reduced, mainly because the money was no longer there. Strikingly, Syria tried to liberalize somewhat in those years, while the USA was ramming liberal shock therapy down Iraqi throats. In both cases, it was a failure that further undermined the government's popularity. Farmers fled to the city, where unemployment was already rife. And while normal people had to fend for themselves, people like Bashar's cousin al-Maklouf continued to gobble up wealth. And yet, at first it seemed that the Arab Spring would pass him by. Assad boasted that this was because he had dared to stand up to the West, unlike Ben Ali or Mubarak, and that his people respected him for that. More to the point, his subjects were more divided than Tunisians or Egyptians. His modest reforms had created some winners, notably the secular middle classes, expected little good to come out of a revolution. And while the common people were divided, the elite kept acting as a monolithic bloc. The main reason was probably that it was almost entirely made up of Alawites, a tiny minority. They were rightly fearful of what might happen to them if the regime would fall and the Sunni majority would take over. It would be as if Mubarak's regime had been entirely made up of Coptic Christians. Fear also explains the initial restraint on the part of the Syrian population. Everyone was aware that the Secret Service had legions of informers on the payroll, and there were no illusions about how they would handle protesters. But just to make sure that no one doubted that, Secret Service responded disproportionately to every act of defiance, to the point where they overdid it. They followed Machiavelli's advice that it was better to be feared than loved, but they forgot the other half of his famous maxim, namely, to make sure that fear doesn't turn into hatred, which is what you can expect if you start torturing children. After the Damascus Spring, Bashar argued that the time was not ripe to rein in the goons. His chair was still too wobbly. But by 2011, it was too late. Once the genie of insurrection was out of the bottle, the gloves came off, legitimacy became unachievable, and therefore irrelevant. The only tool they had left was fear, and the only remaining goal, self-preservation. Perhaps that had always been the case. If Assad is himself driven by fear, I guess that would make him all too human. You could say that terror breeds terror, and we human beings are merely its tools. In this episode, we've seen more than once that the line between terrorism and state terrorism can be rather fluid. When the Syrian regime had to cede control over some parts of its territory, it resorted to terror tactics. Similarly, the Saddam regime morphed into a terror group when it was driven from power, only to switch back into a sort of state later. In the next episode, we will see that terror has always been present in these states. Thanks for listening. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share with me, you can always leave a message on Spotify. Talk to you soon. Bye.